Well, good morning. Welcome to Hardline. Sorry, we had a few technical issues, but we are here. We are live, obviously. Sunday morning, we won't talk about what the date is. That will not come up today on the show. We've got a lot to talk about. We're starting with legislator Lindsay Larigo in just a few seconds. Ken Crulley will join me next segment. And then Dave Leventhal and GOP candidate for mayor of Buffalo, James Gardner. So lots to get to. Let's get started with Erie County legislator Lindsay Larigo. Lindsay, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Joe.
Let's start. I know the state of the county was this week. Lots to talk about there, but let's talk about a few days before that. The county announced a plan to take over the former Westwood Country Club site. Your thoughts on this and the county's plans going forward with this property?
Look, I was disappointed that the first time I heard about this as a county legislature was when the press conference happened. I think it does not send the right message about having a transparent and open Erie County government to take over or even say that this is essentially a done deal when it's not. It's still up for legislative approval. But for the county to put $6.7 million into a park that it doesn't own yet and bring on a new asset when we have assets that we still need to take care of. We have buildings that are crumbling in downtown Buffalo that we own that we need to take care of. And our financial situation is not what it used to be. We are not ending the year with hundreds of millions of dollars of surplus. We have a $23 million surplus. And to bring on a new county asset at this point that's going to cost taxpayers millions of dollars every year, I don't think it's the responsible move. I think this is nothing more than the county executive bailing out his friends in Amherst who bonded out $8 million and didn't know what to do with the park. I think this is nothing more than a Hail Mary for some candidates that have to answer some tough questions in the town of Amherst this year.
Talking about the cost, I mean, what are we looking at from what you know? What are we looking at as an annual cost of this property for Erie County?
Well, and that's what you're not really going to get a straight answer out of. Initially, we're going to have to, the plan from Mark is to develop it and revive 9 holes on the course and then to put in some walking paths. The town of Amherst is going to develop a piece of it before they turn it over to the county. And I think that's something important for Amherst residents to think about. Your town borrowed $8 million that you're going to continue to pay while the town will not own this asset at all. If the town were to continue to operate this park, you would probably have town employees there in the summer, think high school jobs, make a minimum wage. They're the ones that are going to be taking care of the park. As soon as it's a county park, those jobs are not minimum wage jobs. Those are $70,000 groundskeeper jobs. The cost for the county to take it over will be ginormous compared to what it could be if the town were to keep it. And the town will have no financial interest in the park whatsoever, while their taxpayers will continue to pay that $8 million in debt. In terms of what the county's going to pay year over year, we know, given the balanced budgeting amendments that Mark is proposing and sent over just a day after he made this announcement, we know that they want to add more jobs to the Parks Department. We know that it'll take millions of dollars just to keep this maintained. The county does own 2 golf courses. It's not like those tee times are filled constantly. So the cost is it's going to be huge, and these are recurring costs that we're just going to be adding to the tax book. As to the tax bill, I'm sorry for the taxpayers, as county government continues to grow, and I just don't think it's the responsible move at this time.
Now, that was a part of his State of the County address that he gave on Wednesday evening. Other things that he brought up before we get to the national things he brought up, other county issues he brought up. I mean, as someone who's, serving out, I believe, his now fourth term as county executive, what were your thoughts of his comments on Wednesday?
Mark Poenkers and I fundamentally disagree on a lot of issues. And what I saw at the State of the County was that he believes the solution to problems is throwing county dollars at it and growing county government. I don't think that's the way that we solve the problems in Erie County. I was disappointed to see that what I hoped we would address some of the issues that we're facing in the county, considering the fact that since he's taken over office, the county budget has doubled. I think it's irresponsible to keep looking at problems and saying, let's just throw some tax dollars at it and see what happens. It was largely uninspiring. He talked about some of the homeless crisis that we're dealing with in Erie County. Again, his solution is to throw money at it. Right now, the county is building affordable housing units at $500,000, roughly a unit. I don't think that addresses the underlying causes of homelessness. I think, again, it's just throwing money at a problem, hoping it'll fix it. And I just don't think that that's the solution. Some of the other things he discussed, you know, he talked about ErieNet, which is a promise he made years ago to at one of his state of the county addresses that he was going to bring broadband internet to dark parts of the county. It has been years. We are over $6 million into spending on ErieNet, and not a single individual is being provided internet service. He's claiming that as a win. I think it's insulting, and I think it's the epitome of the problem, that you can't just throw more government at a problem and hope it is the solution. We talked about the ambulance service. He gave an update that he plans on expanding those services to Tonawanda. Again, this is a situation that we need to address. I represent several of the rural areas that really struggle with getting ambulance service out there. I was not in the legislature when this was proposed as a solution to create a county ambulance. But again, it's just like the parks. Once you put a county government in there as the solution, the jobs cost more, you get unions involved, and then there's complications with how the jobs run from there. I think what we should have looked at from the get-go, instead of putting $4 million into an ambulance service that now they want to add 27 more new jobs to, I think we should have looked at a private partnership, just like Niagara County does. That would have been the best deal for taxpayers and probably gotten us better services, because I know we still have high response times from the county ambulance service. So it really was lackluster, I would say. It was a lot of grandstanding. There were a lot of pictures of himself and his presentation. 13, if any county legislator happened to be counting, was the number they would have found. But I, you know, it was largely uninspiring. I wish we had more solutions for the county and less focus on his political complaints.
You talked about ErieNet, and this is something that he had been talking about since before the pandemic. I mean, has the goal of that changed in the eyes of the county executive? What's the messaging you're hearing other than what was said at the state of the county?
You know, that's a really good point, and I think it's something that might get overlooked. So at the beginning of ErieNet, it was really about, again, I represent several rural districts, Concord, Sardinia, the places that have the dark parts of the county, which when I say that, I mean they don't have access to high-speed internet. That's really where those places are. The original proposal was to address bringing broadband to those locations. The first wires just started going up a few weeks ago, conveniently before the state of the county, and they're in the town of Boston, and we don't have any providers yet that have signed a contract that they're going to tap into the line. So a problem that was meant to address an area that doesn't have access to high-speed internet, we're just putting up poles in a place, and I say this because I grew up in that area, that has access to high-speed internet. And saying that it's a win. I don't know why the county is now getting into the internet provider business. Again, this is just Mark thinking that throwing some jobs onto the Erie County government that cost taxpayers millions, spending their money, by the time that we can actually hook up to this, it's going to be out-of-date technology, and that's what we've been talking about, for the past several years. I don't know why we keep investing in it, but it's a priority for Mark, and I think he's just changing the messaging from we're going to bring broadband access to dark parts of the county to we've got some wires up, so it's a win, and I completely disagree. I think it's a complete and total failure.
This resident survey that he mentioned at the state of the county, it was also in the Buffalo News, I believe, the day of. Was that the first you had heard about it? And how do we get involved?
That was the first I heard about it. And I think what's very amusing is the follow up to that is Mark posted some sort of graphic about how we're going to get your ideas. And then he listed out what the ideas were. So I think it's very on brand for the county executive to say, I'm going to listen to you and then tell you what you should say. You know, I went to one of his town hall meetings and I had the same reaction there. You know, he does a lot more telling and he's very condescending sometimes in the way that he speaks to residents. So I think he's had 14 years as an elected official in Erie County. The fact that just now he thinks he needs to listen, but it's going to be, a survey that you fill out and then gets filtered through his staff. I think it would be an interesting survey to read the results of if we got the raw data from. But the first thing he said, even in a state of the county, is how he's going to have his staff analyze it. And I think what we're going to see from that is a lot of comments praising the county executive. And I don't think we're going to get an actual look at Erie County. You know, something that I think is important, you know, again, I represent 8 towns and 2 villages. I have community office hours coming up where I go to the different towns and I set them up just to listen to residents. I don't think it's my job as a county legislator to tell them what's best for them. I think it's their job to come talk to me, call me, come to the community office hours and tell me what they're looking for, because it's my job to represent them, not my own interests. And I wish we could see more of that from the county executive. But again, he's had 14 years to listen to residents. I'm not impressed that he's putting out a survey he's going to control now.
And then obviously he ended this with, you know, more commentary on the national politics. It seems like he's spending a lot more time, and this is just me, on social media, writing in the Toronto Sun, going to districts that aren't Erie County, since more time commentating on what's going on in Washington, D.C. than what's actually going on in Erie County.
I mean, that's certainly the case. We've seen that, you know, for the past, I would say, you know, year from the county executive, is that he's highly focused on national politics. You know, we know that he is, it's pretty wide out, open out there that, you know, he has an interest in some sort of higher office for himself. His own party has passed him on that, you know, several times. I think if he wants to run a primary and go for some sort of national federal position, go do it, because we need a county executive that's focused on Erie County and focused on finding solutions that are sustainable, that are responsible, and that will encourage people to stay in Erie County, that will encourage people to come to Erie County because we can make it an affordable place to live. And I just don't think that's the service we're getting right now out of the county executive. He is just highly divisive with his national politics. Again, when I said he was a little condescending before, it is, if you disagree with him, you know, you're wrong. And that's kind of the tone he takes. So I wasn't surprised at the state of the county that he went into more fear mongering. He's really got some Trump derangement syndrome where he's, you know, really talking about all of these things that there's no evidence that it's happening. You know, and he's waving around his constitution saying, you know, Trump is no king, yet we have a county executive who went and announced that the county will be taking over and investing $6.7 million into a golf course. And he named it at that press conference, too. He doesn't have the right to do any of those things. Those are all up for legislature approval. So, you know, and I said in comments, I believe, to one of your reporters after the event, I would encourage him to read the constitution that he waves around. It's really disheartening to see that that's the approach he's taking to a county elected position.
Anything coming up? Obviously, this gets a lot of attention, a lot of eyes on the Rath building. Anything coming up that we should be looking out for?
Yeah. So after the state of the county, what's going on right now is we have our budget balancing amendments. So the county books are closing. As part of that, we have to figure out how much cash we have on hand. And this is where you're seeing a lot of Mark's personal pet projects coming through. So the minority caucus met with Mark in February to get an idea of what financial position we were in. And he said we were going to have no more than a $10 million surplus, which for a $2 billion budget is actually a pretty close gap when you think about, you know, how small things could change to put us in a bad financial position. We are now closing with over a $20 million surplus. That's where you're seeing him come out with some of these pet projects like the Amherst Golf Course, spending one-time funds. These are not reoccurring funds. This is just money that we're closing out with a little extra. He wants to add over 27 new jobs to the county tax roll. And all of these things are going to impact taxpayers. I think it's irresponsible talking about new jobs and new programs should come at budget time when we're planning for a full year of revenue sources. It shouldn't be when we're having a one-time surplus. We should be using surplus for one-time projects that we otherwise maybe couldn't get done. So that's a really important thing that's going on. That's going to be a discussion next week at the county legislature. Another important thing is we have the Charter Review Commission. Again, you know, you have Mark Poelenkers out there waving his constitution. Just last year, on the ballot, the voters overwhelmingly voted down Mark's proposal to take away their voice on extending sales tax, that it wouldn't have to go to referendum. Only a couple months later, he went to the Citizens Charter Review Commission, and he said, I want to put that back on. Even though the people said no, I want to change how we vote on sales tax. So those are some of the conversations we're having. It's kind of a really busy time in county government, and I would encourage everybody to pay attention.
Any meetings with the GOP leaders and the county executive?
No, I don't. We have not had one since that first meeting in February. And honestly, it was pretty disheartening to have that conversation that we were going to end with a $10 billion surplus and then hear radio silence and then Mark come out with all sorts of these programs and hear that he has a $20 million spending program that he never mentioned. It doesn't put a good taste in my mouth. I think it really does not speak to an open and transparent government. I think it speaks to a county executive that thinks he can do whatever he wants without, you know, properly going through the government process. But I don't see another meeting in our future. I've only had two meetings with him since I've been a county legislator for about a year and a half. So I would say I'm not optimistic that that's going to happen again.
Well, one of our texters says, if you'd like to do your own survey and then put the results on this very show, and I agree with the texter, I'd be all open for that. So you have a platform if you want to counter the county executive's survey.
That's a good idea. You know, I might have to look into doing something like that. I am genuinely always curious in finding out what voters think. I always welcome everybody to come to my community office hour sessions or when I'm out in the district. I am happy to hear what you like. I'm even happier to hear what you don't like, because I think that's where we really have an opportunity to make some change. And again, I hope the county executive takes that approach to his survey, but that we might have to look at doing something on our own. I think that's an interesting idea.
Legislator Lindsay Lirigo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That is Erie County Legislator Lindsay Lirigo joining me live here on Hardline. When we come back, we're taking a look at the Mayor of Buffalo election. You've had the budget proposal by Mayor Chris Scanlon and a budget proposal by State Senator Sean Ryan, who's running for Mayor of Buffalo. We'll talk about that with Ken Cruley from politicsandstuff.com. Also get his thoughts on the primary, where it stands, the Democrats having their primary, a lot of focus on that primary over the summer. And, you know, they're endorsing a candidate that's not the current Democratic sitting mayor. We'll ask him about that. Dave Leventhal joining us at 11. James Gardner, GOP candidate for Mayor of Buffalo at 11:30. And at noon, Meet the Press. And this week, President Donald Trump is on Meet the Press. So don't touch that dial. More Hardline after this on WBEN. Welcome back. It is Hardline here on News Radio 930 WBEN. We are live on a Sunday morning, and we are joined this segment by Ken Cruley from politicsandstuff.com. Ken, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Lots going on with the Mayor of Buffalo race. Let's start with the proposed budgets from Mayor Scanlon and State Senator Sean Ryan. State Senator Sean Ryan is proposing a deficit finance, or is proposing to use deficit financing bonds to balance this year's budget. Mayor Scanlon has gone with a approach of he wants to sell off parking garages. He wants to have a bed tax. I think he wants to raise taxes as well. You know, looking at these two plans, Ken, you have history in the finance with a budget director for Erie County. What do you think of the two budget proposals?
Well, they're both presenting kind of radical different approaches. And I think we have to back up for just a second to realize what is bringing these proposals together. The city has a tens of millions of dollar deficit going into the next fiscal year on July 1st. And to solve that, the mayor has proposed a budget which includes some revenues that are kind of iffy. He's proposed some expense lines that are very underfunded and has set up a situation where there is a substantial hole in the budget. That's where we get to the plans. And the mayor's proposal is includes the major part of it is to go after a state legislation which would set up a parking authority. The parking authority would buy the city's ramps, the four ramps, and then manage them. And that would relieve the city of the responsibility. And for that, the city would get a one-time payment. The amount of the payment is kind of up in the air. I've heard numbers anywhere from $40 to $60 million in the actual budget. The mayor is suggesting that it would be a little over $42 million, about 26 of which he would use for the year starting in July. The problem with the parking authority is that, first of all, it needs state legislation, which hasn't been approved. That could happen this month or it could not happen. If it does happen, though, you then have to set up the authority. You have to create a bureaucracy to run this authority. You then have to get the authority to figure out what the value of the ramps are. That's, they're going to have to look at the age of the ramps, the number of spaces, the use of the ramps. And then from that, they're going to try and sell bonds. The selling bonds could be a little bit iffy, depends on the market, depends on the proposal that is being offered as to what the authority and therefore the city is looking for. And so you put all those things together, and we're talking about several months, many, many months of getting things together, even if the authorization for creating the authority was approved in the next few weeks by the state. So that's that leaves the whole 25-26 city budget kind of up in the air, because a lot of things have to happen and fall into place. Senator Ryan's proposal is something that would suggest that we can't resolve the dilemma of the overestimated revenues and underestimated expenses for this budget in the short term without some kind of help. And he's proposing borrowing money through the Buffalo Control Board to get through the next several years as the city tries to get through a structurally balanced budget. That proposal also will need state approval, which Senator Ryan has proposed legislation for that. That's still up in the air, and we haven't any idea at this point whether that's going to happen. There's kind of two borrowing proposals on the table at the moment. The mayor, city controller, and the council majority leader on Friday attacked the proposal from Senator Ryan because of the borrowing, but they, in fact, are proposing a plan which also requires a level of borrowing by this new authority. The other interesting thing is that the city has done this before, as recently as 5 years ago. 5 years ago, the city of Buffalo had a major deficit in the 2019-2020 budget, and because of that, they sold $25 million of deficit bonds. The deficit bonds got them through the year. So, and Mayor Scanlon, as a member of the council, voted for the approval of those deficit bonds. So there's sort of a precedent for what Senator Ryan is talking about. Put it all together, Joe, and everything is really kind of up in the air. I guess perhaps this week, as the state finishes up, hopefully the state budget process, we'll get the Buffalo issues resolved too, but there's no certainty about that right now. So we're sort of in the holding pattern. And on top of that, the city council has to approve a budget by May 26th. And so that's only about 3 weeks away.
Wow. You know, looking at the deficit and the position that the city of Buffalo finds itself in, I mean, is this just from years of mismanagement? What are you pointing to the reason that we are facing this now in 2025?
Well, some of it is questions of I wouldn't characterize it necessarily as mismanagement. I'd characterize it as not being realistic about some budget assumptions. The city has traditionally, for example, underfunded its overtime accounts and then had to scramble during the year to make up the deficit that overages have occurred. In the new budget that the mayor's proposed, he's proposed $24 million for overtime expenses. The city this year is running close to $40 million. So there's a serious problem there. And that is continuing with the proposal from the mayor. The other part of it, though, Joe, is that if the mayor, former Mayor Brown, had taken a different attitude about the budget and about taxes, if he had perhaps gone and approved a couple percent tax increase every year for the 18 or 19 years that he was in office, then we really wouldn't be having this conversation, because there probably would be sufficient tax revenues built up over time to take care of the deficits that are occurring. But because they didn't do that, they've created the problem. The other thing is, when the control board went to advisory status in 2012, the control board left the city with over $100 million in reserves. The city proceeded over the next 6 or 7 years to use up all of those reserves. And then they were in trouble again. But then all of a sudden, with COVID, there came federal relief money, and that bailed the city out again. But we're now in a situation where there is no situation where anything like that's going to drop into their laps. And so that's the reason for trying to sell the parking ramps. But that really doesn't solve the long-term problem.
You know, looking ahead to this primary, the Democratic Party obviously the Erie County Democratic Party put their endorsement with Sean Ryan. But Chris Scanlon is the mayor, a Democratic mayor. Is that a rare situation where the party endorses a challenger to the sitting person in their party?
No, that's not totally rare. That over the last several decades, it's happened several times when Jimmy Griffin was mayor and other situations like that. I think the thing is that the party ran the public meetings of the committeemen over the course of 3 or 4 months, and the result of that was that there was some support for Senator Ryan. Chris Scanlon is the acting mayor, he hasn't been elected to that. It's basically an open seat, and so this is somewhat different than if the mayor had been already elected to that seat and he was running as the incumbent.
Other than the endorsement from the Democrat Party, obviously, you know, you see State Senator Ryan getting a lot of endorsements, but looking forward, is anyone right now, in your opinion, have the upper hand in this primary?
I don't think so. I think it's going to be a very, very competitive race. Both Scanlon and Ryan have substantial bankrolls, at least as of last January. They each had about $500,000 available to spend. I'm sure that they've raised a lot more since then. We'll get a new next financial report in about 2 or 3 weeks, so we'll see where they stand. I think they're and the way they're slugging it out on issues with the budget, that it's going to be a very competitive race. There's, of course, three other people in the Democratic primary. Former Commissioner Whitfield. There's Councilman Wyatt and Anthony Tyler Thompson, who formerly worked for Crystal Peoples. So where they stand is a little bit more difficult to get a reading, because they haven't been as much in the public focus as Ryan and Scanlon have been. And again, if they've been able to raise any money or not, we'll see that in 3 weeks, and that will, in some respects, tell us how competitive they are. But we're down to the last 7 weeks before the primary, so it's hard to get traction if you haven't gotten it already.
Wow, I can't believe the primary is that close. We've been talking about it for so long, and it's almost here. You know, obviously, I'm always reminded on election day of all the minor parties, right? You've got Democrat, Republican, and you've got the down ballot parties. Anyone running in the Democrat primary already guaranteed a space in November?
Yes, Senator Ryan has the endorsement of the Working Families Party, so he'll be on the ballot in November. Because of that, the Conservative Party, as far as I know, has not endorsed a candidate. The Republican Party, of course, has James Gardner, although there's been some suggestions that he might just be a placeholder for a substitute candidate, but that hasn't happened. And then Michael Gaynor, who has circulated Democratic petitions which were disqualified, is circulating petitions to have an independent line in November. Same token, Chris Scanlon is circulating independent petitions so that if he wins the Democratic primary, he'll have two lines. If he were to lose the Democratic primary, he would still have a line going into November. So it looks like this could very well stretch out right through November, regardless of the turnout of the primary.
Wow. Well, Ken, we'll be chatting with you leading up to this primary and leading up to Election Day. Now, you do write politicsandstuff.com. I got to ask you, do you think the Bills will have a Christmas Day game this year?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. Well, I guess we'll see. Knowing the weather at this time of the year, I don't know how anxious that they would be for home game that day, but you never know. I mean, they certainly got high recognition, and that comes with national games on games such as Christmas. I guess we're doing 3 games this year on Christmas.
That's right. You got the 2 Christmas Day and then the Thursday night game.
Yeah, so I would say it's probably pretty likely, but I think I could pick a winner for the Democratic primary before I could pick the NFL schedule, because that's a lot harder to read and figure out.
For sure. Hey, Ken, always great catching up with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
That is Ken Crilly from politicsandstuff.com. When we come back, we'll get a quick wrap-up on things going on nationally from ABC. And then at 11 o'clock, Dave Leventhal will be joining me live from D.C. It's Hardline. No, well, hold on. I'm not live in D.C. Dave Leventhal is live in D.C. And he will join us after the news here on Hardline. This week, we marked the 100th day of President Trump's second term, non-consecutive, in office. And to talk about that, our favorite Washington insider, Dave Leventhal. Dave, good morning.
Good morning to you, Joe. Also, likewise, my favorite.
Oh, yes. Well, hey, there we go. I appreciate the appreciating. Now, Dave, I was flying. I had a connection in D.C. on Friday, and I was thinking, oh, well, I should just stop here and just, go talk to people on the street. But you talk to the important people on the street, Dave. Marking 100 days, what sticks out to you of President Trump's second term?
Well, it depends who you're talking to. If I am walking around Capitol Hill, for example, and talking to Republicans and lawmakers who support Donald Trump and were there in 2024 doing all that they could to get him elected, they are elated, and they see the first 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency being a delivery on exactly what he said he was going to do during the election. And that ranges from immigration to economic issues to making sure that the United States was in the driver's seat on international issues, and it especially pertains to border issues. So whatever checkbox you want to check, they are very, very, very pleased and incredibly happy. But here in Washington, D.C., let's remember, this is a Democratic town by and large. There are 700,000 people who live in the District of Columbia. It's a metropolitan area of about 5 million, and many of them are liberal-leaning. And so the people who have been profoundly affected by the layoffs and buyouts and contraction of the federal government, I mean, this is a city that has changed in such a major way in just 100 days because of that, and isn't even getting $1 billion worth of money that had been intended to help run the city at the same time. So I know we're delving into municipal issues, but this is an underappreciated story that has really just roiled the nation's capital in ways that a lot of people don't see, but feel very acutely if you live here.
Yeah, for sure. Dave, also this week we marked a new prime minister in Canada. How is that reflecting in D.C.?
Well, this really speaks to sort of a broader issue of the United States' role on a national stage or on an international stage. And what we saw in Canada was a rebuke of the Trump administration. There's no other way to put it. I mean, conservatives in Canada, the Conservative Party in Canada, 4 months ago, they were on a rocket sled toward victory. Justin Trudeau, the prime minister then, Liberal prime minister, incredibly wildly unpopular. And yet, the Liberal Party was able to turn it around in the most incredible of fashions and retain the power in Canada and do so in a way that was squarely focused on what was happening in the United States. So, but for Donald Trump, the Conservatives would probably be leading Canada right now. It's almost assured, but yet we're going to have a very different government and relationship with Canada as a result. And this is just one of a number of different countries that we could point to where the nature of the United States' relationship with those countries has changed in a way that would have been, not to quote the Princess Bride here, but inconceivable just a few months ago. And we're talking about countries that were allied with, or arguably were allied with, and not so much right now, like Denmark, where Donald Trump is basically saying, hey, Denmark, know that we have gotten along with you for decades and decades, pretty much ever since World War II, but we want to take part of your country. And, you know, we probably won't take it by force, but can't promise you that. And then going back to Canada, trying to make it our 51st state, and Donald Trump just refusing to move from that position. And a lot of people thought he was joking at first, but clearly Canada did not think he was joking in the way that they dealt with their own domestic politics. This extends to Mexico. It extends to Panama and, you know, even England in the UK in just the past couple of days. Donald Trump basically saying, hey, you're being subservient to China, and really ringing that bell in a major way that has disquieted folks across the pond. You know, where does this end? I think the answer to that is there's no telling, because Donald Trump clearly wants to make the United States the aggressor in international affairs and does not want any other country dictating to the United States the future of United States foreign policy and economic policy as well. And that's really where we get into the issue of tariffs.
I was just going to say, speaking of international policy, speaking of relations with other countries, where are we on tariffs? We're in the middle of that 90-day pause. What's the chatter like?
Yeah, well, 90-day pause is a relative term. I mean, we still have a 10% across-the-board tariff for most countries, and we have exponentially larger tariffs that are affecting China. And here's another thing that I think is underappreciated at this point, because it just hasn't happened yet, but if we stay on the same path, it absolutely will, which is that these Chinese tariffs are going to begin to affect consumers maybe in about 6 weeks to 2 months in a way that just isn't the case right now. So many things that we rely on here in the United States, and it ranges from clothing to shoes to electronics and furniture and toys and plastic products, they come from China. So the aspiration here for Donald Trump is that these types of products will be made in the United States, and that we're not going to have to rely on China or Vietnam or any other country in the world to produce these types of products and materials. But at the same time, too, you just can't snap your finger and suddenly have tens and hundreds of billions of dollars worth of production just suddenly materialize in the United States without building factories and infrastructure and all the other types of investments that would go into it, if it's even possible in the first place, which many economists just simply don't think it is feasible. But put that aside for a second. The acute issue here is all the stuff that you love to get when you go on Amazon.com or you go to your favorite retailer and you expect it fast and you expect it at a decent price. That stuff coming from China is suddenly going to get one of two things, or go one of two ways. It's either going to get a whole heck of a lot more expensive, or it's not going to be available because China won't be shipping it. And already we see some of the ports in the western coast of the United States having fewer imports coming in the first place. And that is likely to increase in a significant way. The decrease will increase, if you will. And if you just simply don't have stuff coming in, well, where are you going to get it? And that really just speaks again to the gap that between the reality of where we are today and the aspiration of Donald Trump for making domestic production increase. The numbers just don't add up. And we are not to the point where we are even in a small fraction of a way toward that goal of having all the stuff that gets produced in China and elsewhere produced in the United States.
With the other countries, obviously, some have come and talked with Trump. Have there been any deals announced when it comes to tariffs?
Yeah, well, this is a moving target. And everything I just said put a gigantic asterisk next to it, in the sense that Donald Trump can change his mind whenever he wants to. He has incredible power that Congress has given him to dictate what he wants when it comes to tariffs. And we've already seen this before. I mean, Donald Trump has threatened tariffs. He has enacted tariffs. He had pulled tariffs back. He had put them back into place. He has had pauses. He has unpaused the pauses. I mean, so much has happened in 100 days regarding tariffs that anyone who is trying to pay attention to this literally needs to go and like study what has happened just to make sense of it and to track what has happened and what has not happened. So because of that, and because of Donald Trump's approach to this, which has been, regardless of how you feel about him, it's been incredibly chaotic. You may like that strategy, you may not, but it's sometimes been kind of no rhyme or reason, or at least minimum an ability to predict where this is all going. So bottom line is that if Donald Trump wanted to just kind of undo this, he could, and the world would have to react to it. That is part of the attraction, especially for Trump supporters, is that, hey, well, maybe we might have some pain here, and maybe this is going to be a little bit turbulent for a while, but the United States is telling everyone else what to do instead of everyone else telling the United States what to do when it comes to economics and policy and trade. And that is something that is very attractive for about 30, 35, 40% of the country that isn't so concerned about the details, at least not yet, but is very concerned about the United States' stature and status in the world and being first, not among equals, but first period.
Back here at home, Dave, has there been a Democratic governor with Donald Trump as much as Gretchen Whitmer?
The easy answer, Joe, is no. And part of that is by design, and part of it is by circumstance. But Michigan looms very, very large in Donald Trump's strategy here. And let's remember that Michigan was, of course, pivotal in Donald Trump winning the presidency for a second term. It's a place that he has gravitated toward throughout his entire now decade-long political career at the national level. He had major rallies there all throughout the elections that he's run, and he would go there right before elections too. And also too, so much is happening in Michigan in regards to the auto industry that is very central to Donald Trump's economic policy. So when you add that all up, Gretchen Whitmer can't really avoid Donald Trump, but it's in also too, she has political ambitions of her own and doesn't want to clearly be seen as somebody who is so just virulently anti-Trump that she would lose popularity in her own home state. So she's walking a very, very narrow and politically dangerous line here. Even spoke at a Trump presentation that he was giving in Michigan. So it's definitely weird to see, and something that you almost certainly wouldn't see if, for example, Donald Trump came to New York. Couldn't imagine Kathy Hochul doing something similar, at least at this point in time.
This week in cabinet news, Mike Waltz, now did he resign and will now be up for UN ambassador?
Yeah. Poor UN ambassador job. I mean, Elise Stefanik from upstate New York, a representative, she was tapped for that job, and all indications seem that she was going to get it until Donald Trump basically said, oops, sorry, we need you back in the U.S. House, kind of bowing to the reality that if she left that job and a special election occurred where a Democrat won her seat, then the House Republicans, who only have just a couple of votes here right now of a majority in the U.S. House, would have one vote less. And that could be enough to torpedo certain Trump policies, or even worse, if Republicans had a couple of other departures for one reason or another. So it was just a pure numbers game. But Elise Stefanik was not happy about that. And so, yeah, you know, I mean, we've got ourselves in a situation now where Donald Trump just can't keep a national security advisor. When you add them up from his first term and his second term, you now have eight different people serving in that job, either on a permanent, and I put that in serious quotation marks, or an acting basis. And this is, you know, people may not be thinking about the national security advisor all the time, but this is an incredibly powerful and influential job. Somebody who literally is there to advise the president as much as anyone else on matters of keeping this country safe in times of peril. And you know, the president should be relying on that person, again, as much as anyone else for that type of work. So that is a concern. And Marco Rubio right now has four different jobs. He's the Secretary of State. He is on an acting basis serving as National Security Advisor, and he's nominally over the head of USAID and also the National Archives. So for somebody who Donald Trump loved to beat up on and deride and called him Little Marco 101 different times in a very short span during his first campaign, and otherwise just considered him to be a massive political lightweight, Marco Rubio has some incredible sway right now in the Trump administration and in ways that nobody could have predicted, again, even a couple of months ago, Joe.
Any names coming up that will replace him as the permanent secretary?
There are a few, and one to keep an eye on would be Stephen Miller, the deputy chief of staff for Donald Trump, who has been one of the most outspoken critics of Joe Biden on the immigration front, somebody who has a definite public profile for better or for worse, somebody who you likely see on television a lot or hear from on the radio, and somebody who is one of Donald Trump's most loyal and closest advisors in the White House, who has been with him all throughout Donald Trump's political career and was a chief Donald Trump supporter even during Donald Trump's darkest times after the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol and leaving the White House. And it seemed as if Donald Trump's political career was over. Stephen Miller stuck with Donald Trump, and Stephen Miller was there all throughout supporting Donald Trump through his third campaign and second run for the presidency and winning run for the presidency. And he's getting rewarded as a result of this. Not to say that Stephen Miller will get that job, but he's definitely one of the people right now who is considered here in Washington, D.C. to be a leading contender for it.
Let's look at polling, because right now, President Trump has lost some points since the last time you and I talked, but Democrats also at an all-time low. Is it just that nobody likes Washington, D.C. right now, Dave?
Well, you know, even on its best day, nobody outside of Washington, D.C. seems to be particularly in love with what's going on here, but it is particularly bleak, and it's really on both sides of the coin. And that is not false equivalency, Joe. That is real equivalency. And the Democrats and Donald Trump both have their own discrete issues to grapple with. Let's deal with Donald Trump first. He is not very popular around the country. He is incredibly popular with people who will always support Donald Trump. And that, again, goes back to sort of that 35% to 40% of Americans who, regardless of what Donald Trump does, just the fact that Donald Trump is president of the United States is enough for them, because that is a better situation in their minds than any Democrat. And it doesn't matter who it is, whether it's Barack Obama or Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton or Kamala Harris or anyone else, Donald Trump will always be better, and that's how they're going to feel. So as a result, there's sort of a polling floor, if you will, for Donald Trump that it almost seems impossible at this stage of the game, not to say that it completely is, but almost impossible that Donald Trump will dip into the range of, say, George W. Bush at the end of his second term when he was underwater to the tune of in the 20 percentage point range for popularity. So that doesn't seem to be in the cards for Donald Trump. But it's also going to be very difficult for Donald Trump from a pure prurient political standpoint to really gain a lot of momentum going into the 2026 midterm elections, dare I bring them up already, when his popularity is flagging. So he is aware of that. He pays very close attention to the polls, and he wants to be popular, and he wants to have success in a way that's going to help his agenda going into those elections. But if that is not necessarily totally, completely in place and the case, that's going to be difficult for some Republicans who are in key districts that you can expect that they're going to be very close races. And the risk here is that Donald Trump probably doesn't lose the Senate because the numbers just really don't work out. But Republicans are very much at risk of losing the House. And that is a consideration in all of this, even at this relatively early juncture, Joe.
Dave, you have a piece. The FCC dismissed a pro-Trump legal group's complaint against Biden and Bragg. What is this all about?
Yeah, well, the Federal Election Commission, some news that kind of floated under the radar a little bit, but the Federal Election Commission actually entered a de facto shutdown period. And let's review in 10 seconds here. The Federal Election Commission enforces and regulates campaign finance laws in this country. So anything to do with money and campaigns, They're the guys who are the cops on the beat, except they can't enforce and regulate laws anymore. And that's because they don't have enough commissioners to do so. They have six commissioners. They're down to only three people filling those spots. Who is responsible for nominating commissioners to the FEC? Well, that is Donald Trump, and he hasn't done so yet. And the U.S. Senate has to approve them. So the FEC is kind of dead in the water at this point. But to the headline that you just mentioned, I wrote a piece in Notice, a nonprofit news organization, last week about one of the final acts that they did before this, they entered the shutdown period, which was dismiss a case. We mentioned Stephen Miller just a moment ago. Well, Stephen Miller last year, as part of a pro-Trump nonprofit organization that he run, a legal organization, basically accused Alvin Bragg and Joe Biden of conspiring against Donald Trump and doing so in a way that violated election laws. And the Federal Election Commission, which is evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans, they, in a unanimous decision, rejected that complaint and told Stephen Miller's organization that that their complaint was unjustified and that no election laws were broken. So that was kind of a big deal in the sense that it adds on to a couple of other wins for pro-Trump organizations at the Federal Election Commission. One involved NPR, which was a similar complaint from a different group, saying that NPR was, in essence, being run by the Democratic Party. The FEC said it wasn't. And another one against the Washington Post, which was of a similar nature, and the FEC unanimously said that that was untrue. So the backdrop here is that, of course, Donald Trump came out last week and said, hey, look, I'm not going to pay attention to the FEC. We're going to go right to the Justice Department, and I want them to investigate Act Blue, which is the Democratic payment processor for all the billions of dollars that go to Democrats. He feels that Act Blue has been acting outside the boundaries of election law, and the FEC, which is a civil body, doesn't have its own police force. I didn't even pay attention to the FEC, as he clearly has not been doing because it's shutting down, and went right to the Department of Justice and Attorney General Pam Bondi to go and investigate that. I know that's a lot of information. I'll jump into a couple of minutes here, but it's definitely a storyline that people should be paying attention to, probably more than they are, because it will have real ramifications for the election coming up next year.
Oh, wow. Dave, we could go a whole other segment, definitely, if not more. But great chatting with you. Great catching up. Our Washington insider, Dave Leventhal. Dave, as always, thank you so much. And we look forward to hearing you 6:50 Tuesday morning.
I am looking forward to being there. Thanks, Joe.
That is Dave Leventhal, Buffalo Zone. When we come back, speaking of Buffalo, the mayor of Buffalo, well, the candidate for mayor of Buffalo, the GOP candidate, James Gardner, will join me for the final Hardline segment. It is Hardline here on News Radio 930 WBEN. Yes, it is the final segment of Hardline here on News Radio 930 WBEN. If you missed any of this fantastic show, and that's no thanks to me, it's all thanks to my guests and John Anthony, you can go back and listen to it on demand. Or tonight, 6 o'clock, we'll replay the show in its entirety. So come on back tonight, 6 o'clock. My final guest of the day is GOP candidate for mayor of Buffalo, James Gardner. James, thank you for joining me this morning, especially on such short notice.
Joe, it's always a pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the different budget proposals from the other side of the aisle, it's been a few weeks since we checked in. How's the campaign going in the city of Buffalo?
It's going actually very well, Joe. I mean, as you might imagine, I've been as entertained as I'm sure all of you have been with the Democratic primary. And that has been certainly where most of the action and focus has been, and I can completely understand that. But while they've been bickering and poking each other, I've been out interacting with city residents and learning from them what they'd actually like and what they actually need from city government, rather than telling them what they're actually going to get. And it's been a very informative several weeks for me. I've really enjoyed it. It's the best part of the campaign is interacting with city residents, and we're really really looking forward to making our case to voters come the general election.
Again, the budgets are the news right now, especially going into the Democratic primary. But you look at the situation the city of Buffalo finds itself in. You know, James, you look back on how the city finances were handled for the last 5-10 years. What do you think got us to this point, to where the city really is facing a fiscal crisis?
Well, I mean, the most entertaining part of this is that, you know, the contenders on the Democratic side seem to be asking city residents, even though they're the parties that got them into this mess, that they're going to be the appropriate party to get them out of it. You know, there's been a total abrogation, a total abandonment of fiscal responsibility in city finances for decades. And they've been able to sort of paper things over, actually, through the largesse of the COVID funding and things like that, one-time revenue streams, which is a trend that continues to this day, without really taking the necessary steps as a common council and as the executive, as from the mayor's office, to really ensure that the city was on sound financial footing. I mean, we don't have to go back that far, Joe. I mean, if you go back to the 2023 budget, the difference, the size of the expenses have grown $43 million from 2023 to the proposed budget by the acting mayor here. And I can assure you, as a city resident, I haven't enjoyed a $43 million increase in the level of services that City Hall has provided. So we don't have to go back. This isn't a total doom and gloom scenario. And part of what I anticipate after the conclusion of the Democratic primary is being able to lay out my priorities and what I think that how the city budget should be constructed is, at a starting point, we just need to go back to where the funding levels that the city had in 2023, and we only have a $20 million budget gap to bridge, which is a heck of a lot easier than a $60 million budget gap. But as you can see, and as anybody who looks at these numbers realizes, that it's a $60 million budget deficit this year. It's only going to grow unless extreme but conscious efforts are made to control the spending, to cut the revenue, the expense side of the budget. That's where we need to start. And before we ask for city residents and city businesses to pay one extra dollar in taxes and fees, the government has to make the effort to rein in that spending, to right-size government, to get back to the brass tacks of what city, municipal government, and the services that they're supposed to be providing. And until we do that, we're going to be wandering in the wilderness and destined to a fiscal control board, a hard fiscal control board, that's going to force these changes on the city. So that's the lay of the land. And until we get a change in leadership, and until someone gets serious about reining in costs, right-sizing government, this is going to be a perpetual problem for the city.
What are your thoughts? Mayor Scanlon wants to do away with, get out of the parking business, and Mayor Scanlon also wants to have a bed tax for hotels in the city of Buffalo. What are your thoughts on that proposal?
I mean, they're both ridiculous. First of all, with the bed tax, both of those proposals require legislative action from Albany. And frankly, we know the governor's doing a victory lap and patting herself on the back for passing this budget. But what we don't know are the details. We don't know whether these proposals actually made it. And my gut tells me that they didn't. So, and even with this bed tax it's not raising a tremendous amount of revenue. And all it does is penalize people who are coming to our region. That is exactly the level of wrongheaded thinking that has plagued city government for probably the past 50 years. We're going to make it harder, less attractive for people to come in here, less attractive for people to invest here. It's wrong. Same thing goes with the parking ramp discussion. Those are city assets that not only produce revenue produce revenue for the city of Buffalo, which is hard to come by these days. It's also the maybe the more crucial element of it is the fact that it allows the city to essentially subsidize businesses that are doing business here. That's the comparative, that's the only comparative or thing that the city can do to help make it more a more attractive place to do business versus Amherst or Hamburg or some of these suburban communities where you can move your corporate office park and they have an ocean of surface parking, right? I mean, that's one of the least, you talk to business owners, that's one of the most least, the least attractive thing about the city is doing business there is parking. Parking's an issue. And the city, by virtue of owning those parking ramps, the city is able to act and to keep the cost of that parking down to the point where employees and patrons are able to come down and are willing to come down and do business in the city of Buffalo. So the idea that we should be auctioning those assets off, incurring a debt, because that's how this whole thing is going to get paid for. It's going to get auctioned off, or they're going to sell it in this paper transaction to another authority, another branch of government that's going to be bloated by patronage jobs, and the way that they're going to be able to afford to buy these parking ramps is by issuing bonds that the city ultimately is going to have to pay. Right, so you're getting rid of a revenue stream, you're adding debt, adding another bureaucratic layer of government, and you're potentially losing the control to manage what parking rates are set in the city. It's a total loser, should not be considered. What they should be doing is looking at ways to cut their spending, not these one-time things that in 2 years you're going to blow through all this the money that you got from issuing bonds, and where are you? Just with another debt obligation that the city without a revenue stream to pay for it, and that's the crucial point.
Yeah, speaking of bonds, that seems to be all of Senator Sean Ryan's proposal is to borrow the money to balance this budget. But I mean, again, this is my opinion. It seems like, you know, 5 years down the road, that's just going to cause another issue like we're in today.
Absolutely. All that. I mean, at least you can say this for the acting mayor's plan. At least that plan is tied to a tangible asset. Sean Ryan's plan is just throw it on a credit card. I mean, and you can talk to any business, any family. If you're in financial hardship, the last thing you should be doing is incurring more debt. And that's exactly what his plan is. We're just going to borrow more, and somehow we're going to figure out how to pay for it down the way. What everybody running for mayor should be doing is looking at why are our costs going up the way that they are? How is it possible that in a 2-year period, our costs have exploded $43 million? How is that possible? What changes need to be made to bring that size of government back down, to limit our costs? And I mean, until we do that, it's just, as I said, all it is setting a course on a hard fiscal control board for the city of Buffalo, which is going to force these changes on the city anyway. And no one's going to like it. No one's going to be better for it. It would be much better if these politicians would instead be honest with taxpayers and say, you know, what we really need to do here is we really need to right-size government and bring down the costs and make the necessary trims on the expense side before we deal with the revenue side, because you're not taxing your way out of this problem. You're not raising fees to get out of this problem. You have to address the structural fundamental issues, which are the expenses.
You know, you said you're keeping your eye on on what's going on the other side, heading into the Democratic primary. Other than the budget, what else have you noticed from some of your opponents?
Well, I think there's always going to be, you know, I think the budget side of things is obviously, as you pointed out, taking up a tremendous amount of oxygen. But some of the things that I think, without a doubt, that's the biggest part of it. But what we have to be very careful here on is ensuring that whatever budget changes get made, whatever expense changes get made, we have to make sure that we're delivering the essential services to city residents. So that's police. We saw how important the fire department was just this past week with that 4-alarm fire downtown. I mean, you have to make sure that the roads, you have to make sure that the city is fulfilling the bare functions that city residents need in order to make this place, make the city worth living in. But apart from that, I think you need to look at, you know, there's always going to be a discussion about affordability and housing and things and things like that, discussions like that. And I think that is, again, an area that has to be really looked at carefully here. And I know the city owns and is sitting on a tremendous portfolio of property, and they're just sitting on it. One of the key things that the city could be doing is auctioning and selling off those assets, those parcels of land, and getting those parcels back on the tax roll. Again, you have to look for revenue streams where you can find it, and the more equitable way to do it, rather than raising taxes on homeowners and businesses who are already getting taxed more than they should be, is putting apartment buildings on these oceans of open land that they have on Sycamore, right? Drive down Sycamore and tell me that, you know, people are running around saying we have an affordability problem. And then you look at the vast open expanses of Sycamore and how you can't envision, or how the city can't facilitate the construction of new housing in areas of the city like that is beyond comprehension.
You know, you talked about and with the budget, the need for revenue and, you know, business and all that. You look at downtown, and obviously downtown seemed to be, you know, on this kind of renaissance before the pandemic. And now, I mean, 20,000-30,000 less people a week are going in downtown Buffalo. How important is downtown Buffalo to Buffalo's future? And, you know, what kind of focus does the government need to make on downtown Buffalo?
It is essential. I mean, it's not just a Buffalo issue. I would make the argument that it's a regional one. The city of Buffalo you can't have a failed, desolate downtown in Erie County and expect people and businesses to want to locate here and do businesses here. I mean, it's essential from a regional perspective that the city does well, but what the city government needs to do is make it an easier place and more attractive place to do business. And I'll warrant, you know, in the next couple of years, it's going to be tough. The city government is going to have to tighten its belt and really reorganize and rethink how they do business. But one of the first things they should be doing is figuring out, and what I plan to do is figure out how to make it a more attractive place to do business. And as I said earlier, the last thing we should be doing is selling off the parking ramps, which are so essential to attracting businesses into the city center, right? What sense does it make for an employer to relocate downtown from either a suburban community or from outside New York State when they can't assure the people that work for them that they're going to be able to park in an affordable way? It doesn't make any sense. And that is one of the core functions of what the mayor needs to be doing. And what I plan on doing is advocating for the city, making it a more attractive place to do business, to live. And what you have to do is, unfortunately, we're going to have to take our medicine here for the next couple of years, but hopefully we're going to emerge on the other side of it with a more sustainable, stable, expenses which will, you know, if a business owner knows that they what their tax burden is going to be, what their costs are going to be, and they can rely on that moving forward, I think the city of Buffalo could be a tremendously advantageous place to do business. And I am very confident when I'm mayor that it will be.
James, as always, thank you so much for joining me, especially on such short notice. I appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Joe.
That is GOP candidate for mayor of Buffalo, James Gardner. And that is Hardline for this May 4th, 2025. My thanks to Erie County Legislator Lindsay Larigo, to Ken Cruley, Washington Insider Dave Leventhal, and GOP candidate for Buffalo Mayor James Gardner. If you missed any of the show, come on back here tonight at 6 p.m. It will be played in its entirety. But stay tuned. President Donald Trump is the guest on Meet the Press after this break on News Radio 930 WBEN. I will be back on Wednesday. So enjoy Monday and Tuesday. Just Brian, I'll be back Wednesday, 9 a.m. for Beamaz and Beamer on News Radio 930 WBEN.